time when the record company doesn't owe you anything, which means you could have to write a check to the producer from your own pocket, which majorly sucks. And the situation can get much worse. Continuing with these same assumptions, let's assume the artist got a $100,000 advance on top of the $120,000 in recording costs. That means the artist won't get any money until both the $120,000 in recording costs and the $100,000 advance are recouped. Meanwhile, the producer, who didn't share in the $100,000 advance, is owed royalties. For example, if the company earns $2 million, check out the next chart on the PDF for this parade of horribles. As you can see, you're $20,000 unrecouped, which means you have no money coming in for a while, but you owe $40,000 to the producer. If that $40,000 number doesn't impress you, try adding a zero to make it $400,000. Do I have your attention? This is one of the times when success can kill you, because the more streams you have, the deeper in the hole you go. In a sense, I'm misleading you. First of all, at some level of success, the artist will recoup and earn enough royalties to pay off the producer. Secondly, part of the reason the artist isn't getting royalties is an advance, which is in his or her pocket. So if you think of advances as prepaid royalties, the artist has already gotten these royalties and has to pay a part of them to the producer. However, unless you're very different from the artists I know, you won't be setting money aside for your producer. Also, much of this problem is caused by the fact that recording costs haven't been recouped, which is not money sitting in your bank account. You can't put those monies aside to cover the producer, even if you want to. Think that's the worst of it? Nah, we're just getting warmed up. Here's how this latest example can get truly miserable. Suppose the deal we just discussed was the artist's first album, and it earned only $300,000 for the company, meaning $30,000 for the artist. This means the album didn't recoup its $120,000 of recording costs, and the producer didn't recoup his or her advance. So far, the artist doesn't owe the producer anything, and everything is fine. From the point of view of our example, that is. The artist's career is, of course, in the toilet. When it comes time to do a second album, the artist ditches this turkey and hires a new producer. Let's assume the second album also cost $120,000, and let's assume the artist's recording fund is $200,000 for both the first and second albums, so that the artist pockets $80,000, the difference between the fund and the $120,000 recording costs on each album. Also assume the second album grosses $3 million and earns $300,000 for the artist. That means the artist has recouped the recording costs of the second album, and the producer of album number two is entitled to retroactive royalties. This means he or she is owed $60,000, 2% of $3 million. Now let's look at how the accounts stack up. First, refer to the chart in the PDF entitled Artist's Account with Record Company. Next, refer to the chart in the PDF that is the computation of album number two's producer royalties. Album number one's producer is not owed any royalties. As you can see from the chart, the producer of album number two is owed $60,000, but the artist is unrecouped by $70,000. If you add a few more unsuccessful albums prior to the big hit, or add a few zeros after these dollar amounts, the artist is nearing 10 on the Richter scale. And the producer ain't gonna be much happier when he or she doesn't get paid. Instead of having a nice, solid record company to send out the producer's royalty checks, he or she now has to chase the artist, who was last seen in Moldavia. If either of these people is you, take two Valium and call me in the morning. So what happens in real life? Any producer who has the slightest idea what they're doing will insist on the record company paying his or her royalties. Any artist who has the slightest idea what they're doing will insist on the record company paying the producer's royalties. Any record company that knows what it's doing will grumble but ultimately do this. The reality is that producers simply won't produce an artist unless the record company gets into the mix. So you can always get the record company to pay the producer when you're unrecouped. It's easy to get them to pay when you're recouped. They just take it out of your money. Unless you're a megastar, they won't contractually agree to pay a producer while you're unrecouped. However, they will accept a letter of direction, known to its friends as an LOD, which is a letter from the artist to the company that says, "Please pay my producer and deduct it from me." The letter will attach a royalty schedule that the producer has agreed to accept, so that the company knows how much to pay them. If you're a producer, be sure all your deals require the artist to send the company such a letter of direction. Without it, you won't get paid. When the company agrees to pay under a letter of direction, they will say that they're doing it only as an accommodation, meaning it's because they love you, not because they have to. In other words, the company has no legal obligation to pay the producer, and the producer has no legal right to sue the company if they don't get paid. The producer can only sue the artist who signed their deal. Neither producers nor artists love this, but it's the best we can do, so they all agree to take it. And as a practical matter, the companies all pay royalties under letters of direction, even if the producers are unrecouped. Before a record company agrees to pay a producer, however, they'll insist on approving the producer's deal. That's to make sure the amount it has to pay while you're unrecouped can't get out of hand. They want to keep the producer's royalty low, not a surprise, but interestingly, they want to keep the producer's advance high. Can you figure out why they want a higher producer advance? Refer to the answer at the end of this chapter, if you can't guess. Whatever payments the company makes are treated as additional advances under your deal. In our example, this means the company would pay the producer $60,000, and you would then be $130,000 in the red, the original $70,000 plus the $60,000 paid to the producer. This makes you further unrecouped, but it's vastly superior to taking the money from your own pocket. Few things aren't. Sound exchange monies. If you're a producer, you want a share of sound exchange monies, which means nothing to you because I haven't told you about it yet. As we'll see later in Chapter 12, artists are entitled to monies when their masters are transmitted digitally, like on Sirius XM, Pandora, and so forth. And those monies are collected by an outfit called Sound Exchange. More about them in Chapter 19. We'll talk about specifics down the road, but the thing to understand now is that, unlike some other countries, producers aren't entitled to Sound Exchange monies unless the artist tells Sound Exchange to pay them. So if you're a producer, it's important that your deal with the artist requires them to send Sound Exchange a letter of direction, similar to what I just described for the labels, telling them to slide some dough your way. The producer's share of Sound Exchange monies is the same percentage of the artist's money that you get for motion picture licenses, a fraction equal to the producer royalty over the artist's all-in royalty. So if the producer has a 3% royalty and the artist has 12%, the producer gets 3/12, or 25%, of the artist's Sound Exchange monies. Recently, the Music Modernization Act adopted some protections for producers in a section cleverly named AMP, meaning Allocation for Music Producers. Those Washington guys are more fun than... Basically, it cleans up some procedural stuff and adds some goodies for old-timers. If you were a producer, mixer, or sound engineer on a sound recording made before November 1, 1995, and you don't have a letter of direction from the artist, you can get 2% of the sound exchange monies if you can't find the artist. If this is relevant to you, check out Title III of the Music Modernization Act, which you can find online. If it's not, don't bother. Mixers. Closely akin to producers are mixers, whose work we briefly discussed back in Chapter 9. Basically, these folks take the multitracks, throw them in a blender, and pour out a mystical potion of sublime music. Mixers both create a mix for the original release of a record and also do remixes for later versions. Great mixers can make a huge difference in the success of a record, and they're paid handsomely. Top pop mixers can get $7,500 to $12,500 per track, though most are in the range of $3,000 to $5,000. Usually this is a one-time payment, but mixers with clout can get a royalty as well. If there are royalties, they're usually from 0.5% to 1%, paid exactly like a producer, retroactive to record one after recoupment of recording costs at the net rate. The per-track money we just discussed, e.g., the $3,000 for mixing, is often a fee, meaning it's not recoupable from royalties. Fee, in industry parlance, means non-recoupable, as opposed to an advance, which is recoupable. For the higher-paid folks, 50% of their upfront money is usually recoupable. When we enter into the hip-hop world of mixers, we walk through the looking glass. The top hip-hop mixers can get $30,000 to $50,000 per remix, and sometimes more. When they also get royalties, and a lot of them do, it can be more than 1%, as high as 2%. As with pop producers, because they're so highly paid, half their money is usually treated as an advance, the other half is non-recoupable. However, at these levels, it's hard to earn enough royalties to ever recoup, especially since a lot of remixing is done only for specific genres, like a dance remix of a pop song, which means the income is limited. Answer to the question about the three top guys at Liberty Records, Simon Waronker, Alvin Bennett, and Theodore Keep, and the artist their first names should remind you of? The Chipmunks. Answer to why a record company would want to keep the producer's royalty low, but keep the producer's advance high? Record companies want you to pay the producer a higher advance so that the producer isn't owed royalties until as late as possible, after which you've recouped more of your deficit. If you're on the fast track, skip ahead to Part 3, Chapter 15. Everyone else, listen on. Chapter 12. Advanced Royalty Computations. Royalties for the United States. We'll start first with United States royalties, because if you're signing to a U.S. company, all other royalties are based on, i.e., a reduced percentage of, the rate for the United States. The royalties we discussed in Chapters 7 and 9 are for exploitations of masters in the United States, meaning streaming, downloads, and CDs. For downloads and CDs, however, those royalties only apply to sales at full price, sometimes called top-line price, because there are reduced royalties for other prices, as you'll see in a minute. Your U.S. rate for full-price exploitations is called, in most contracts, a base rate, or basic rate. By the way, in most contracts, full price means 80% or more of the company's highest wholesale price for the format involved. You'll see why they use 80% in a minute. So if a CD wholesales for $10, full price means anything priced at $8 or more. Let's assume you have a base rate of 10% to make the math easier for the next topic, which happens to be foreign royalties. Even though we Americans think the world stops at our borders, it turns out that people on the rest of the planet actually like music. But if you're a U.S.-based artist, you'll get less money in those other places. If it makes you feel any better, U.K. artists signed to a U.K. company get less in the United States. Feeling better? As streaming takes over, at least one record company now makes a worldwide deal at the same rate for streaming. But other than this outlier, unless you are the most super of superstars, you're going to get a smaller royalty for exploitations outside our border wall, certainly for physical product and possibly downloads. The reduction varies widely from company to company and artist to artist, but as a broad rule, companies give a higher rate in major territories and in territories where they have an ownership interest in the foreign distributor. Today, the majors all have worldwide operations. Conversely, they give a lower royalty in minor territories and in territories where they're only licensing their product to a wholly independent third party. Licensing means they give someone else the right to exploit the masters and get a royalty from those folks. Here's the most common pattern. Canada. Canada has evolved into 85% of the United States rate, with most companies, although some still treat it like any other major foreign territory, as I'll explain in the next paragraph. Using our example of a 10% U.S. basic rate, an 85% rate means you'd get 8.5% for normal retail sales in Canada. With clout, you can sometimes get 90%. Major territories. There are a number of markets in which American product sells particularly well, and these are known as the major territories. They, of course, vary from artist to artist, but in general they are, in no particular order, United Kingdom, Australia, Italy, Japan, Holland, Germany, and France. The remaining European Union countries, Western Europe, and Scandinavia can be treated as majors if you have some clout. The royalty for major territories varies for the same reasons just set forth: ownership versus licensing, artist clout. But it's generally 70% to 75% of the U.S. basic rate, or 7% to 7.5% in our example. With clout, you can get this up to 80%, and sometimes a bit higher for the United Kingdom, like 85%. And in all these places, you should push for a higher royalty on streaming. ROW. ROW stands for Rest of World and means the grab bag of countries left over, which I'll leave to you and Google Maps to figure out. The royalties for these territories generally run around 50% to 66.66% of the U.S. basic rate, or 5% to 6.66% under our assumption. If you have bargaining power, you can sometimes edge this up a bit to 70% or so. Again, try to do better on streaming. While those are the general rules, if you're an artist with a huge following in any particular territory, you can usually negotiate a better royalty for that country. Electronic transmissions. To record companies, every delivery of music that isn't physical is an electronic transmission. As you'd expect, this means streaming and downloads, but it includes much, much more. Typical contract language defines electronic transmissions as something like this: any transmission or delivery to a consumer, whether audio or audiovisual, and/or with other data, by any means now known or hereafter discovered, whether on demand or not, and whether or not a charge is made for the transmission or delivery. So, can you tell what all it picks up besides audio streaming and downloads? Certainly YouTube and any new delivery services that are later invented. But did you notice it also sweeps in radio, TV, and motion pictures? At least when they're streamed or broadcast. More about that later. Before we hit the royalties for electronic transmissions, let me give you the Passman theory of technology cycles. There are predictable patterns that take place every time a new technology hits the record industry. It goes something like this. 1. Because the technology is so new, no one, including the record companies, really understands its economics. Also, when it's first introduced, the thing is usually expensive, and it's a small market. For example, when digital started, the companies had to take all their analog music and turn it into digital, as well as add metadata. Refer back to Chapter 7 for what that is. And set up systems to keep track of the billions of digital uses. All this while the music earned Zippo. 2. The result is a grace period during which royalties on these newbies are not particularly favorable to the artist. This is to give the technology a chance to get off the ground and to help the record company justify the financial risk of going into it. 3. Invariably, this grace period goes on far beyond its economic life, during which time the companies make disproportionate profits. 4. As artist deals expire or are renegotiated, the rates go up. 5. Finally, an industry pattern develops and royalty rates stabilize. Okay, it's showtime. Welcome to the world of electronic transmissions. On-demand streaming. On-demand streaming, also called interactive streaming, means you can listen to any songs in a digital service provider's database anytime you like, and you can pause, skip, rewind, and create playlists. Examples of DSPs offering this service are Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, Amazon Music, and SoundCloud. This is by far the biggest segment of the recorded music business, and it's growing strongly. For these uses, you get your royalty rate applied against the record company's receipts from the DSP. So if they get $10,000 and you have a 10% royalty, you get $1,000. On these services, you're not allowed to permanently download, just listen. Some of the services let you download and listen offline, but the download goes away if you stop paying for your subscription. This is called a tethered download, which we'll discuss in a minute. As of this writing, Spotify, SoundCloud, and YouTube are the only major companies that offer on-demand streams for free, if you don't mind listening to annoying ads. Pandora offers a free service, but it's not interactive. As we'll discuss in a minute, there is pressure on these services to move to a subscription-only basis, meaning the users have to pay a monthly fee to get the music. Services that are subscription-only sometimes offer a free introductory period to try it out, but it's for a limited time. Spotify and YouTube are currently unlimited, but Spotify's free mobile service, which is where the vast majority of the users are, is not fully on demand. YouTube, however, is fully interactive for mobile, and is therefore one of the biggest problems in our industry, as we'll discuss. May I see your ARPU? An important aspect of streaming is something called ARPU, pronounced ARPU. That may sound like a character on The Simpsons, but it means average rate per user. In other words, what's the average amount of money that the streaming service gets from each user? For Apple Music, that's easy. Every user pays a subscription fee, other than for a 30-day free trial period. So if the average subscription fee is $7 per month, the headline $10 per month, reduced by student and family discounts, then Apple Music's ARPU is $7. However, Spotify's ARPU is much lower. Can you figure out why? Remember that Spotify offers a free ad-supported service, then hopes you'll pay a subscription fee to lose the ads. At the time of this writing, Spotify's free users outnumber paid subscribers more than 2.5 to 1. And the ad-supported free users bring in way less money than paid subscribers. Why do ads generate a lot less money than subscribers? Over-the-air radio has about 14 to 16 minutes per hour of advertising, while Spotify has much less. That means, A, Spotify ads can't generate as much money, there's not as much time sold, B, their rates are cheaper than over-the-air ads, and C, because there's less advertising time, there aren't enough ads to annoy people into buying a subscription fee. Accordingly, the ARPU is majorly diluted by the freebie users. In other words, for every $7 per month from a Spotify subscriber, there's 2.5 ad-supported subscribers who bring in far less money, which means the average earnings per stream come out to a much smaller number than they would on a pure subscription service, like Apple Music. This is easier to see with an example, though I'm making up numbers. Assume Spotify had only 2 paid subscribers and 5 free users. That's roughly the ratio that now exists. Also assume that the total ad sales for the free users are $3, and that Spotify gets $2 from each of the 2 paid subscribers, for a total of $4. If you add those together, $7, and divide by the total number of subscribers, 7, you get an average rate per user, ARPU, of $1, which is obviously far less than the $2 it gets from each paid subscriber, and a lot lower than Apple Music, where they get a full subscription fee from every user. So now you understand why the music biz is pressuring Spotify to push its users away from free and into paid subscriptions. Spotify argues that the free service is necessary to get people into the funnel that leads them to paid subscriptions, which is true to some degree. But I understand there are a lot of people who never convert to subscription. This game is still in progress, so stay tuned. The biggest streamer in the known universe. Here's an even bigger problem than Spotify's dilution. Can you guess who delivers more music than any other service? In fact, delivers more music than all the other sites put together, including pirate sites? It's YouTube. YouTube lets customers call up their favorite music and listen to their little heart's content, totally free to the user, though they have to put up with ads. In essence, this means the paid subscription services have to compete with free. In the prior section, you saw how Spotify's free, ad-supported service substantially reduces Spotify's ARPU, and this problem is on steroids when it comes to YouTube. First, as we discussed, there's a lower revenue base because ads generate far less than subscription money. Second, YouTube is the only service that offers consumers a free, unlimited, fully interactive service on mobile, which is where almost all the users are. Huh? The biggest streamer of music pays less per user than the others? How could anyone let that happen? It's because of a quirk in the copyright law, which I'll explain in Chapter 19. But for now, just know that the labels can't really stop them. Accordingly, YouTube pays way less than Apple and Spotify. Put this together with the fact that YouTube delivers more music than anyone else, and you can see that a huge portion of the potential music audience has an abysmal ARPU. Recently, YouTube started a premium service that, although it doesn't release numbers publicly, I'm told is still very small compared to Apple and Spotify. And even as it's growing, the vast majority of all music still goes through their free service. Streaming royalty calculations. So what's all this mean to you as an artist? As we discussed, your royalty rate is applied to what the company gets. So now it's time for Toto to pull back the curtain and let you see the wizard. Well, mostly pull it back. The deals aren't actually public. But I'll show you the outline of his face. Essentially, the streaming services, remember they're called DSPs, meaning digital service providers, pay a portion of their income to the record labels. As I said, the percentages aren't public, but I understand they're in the mid-50% range. For our discussion, I'm going to refer to the percentage of income that the DSP pays to the record companies as the record company's percentage. That's not an industry term. I just made it up because it seems like a reasonable way to refer to a vague percentage. Cool? As we discussed a while back, the record company's percentage is applied to the DSP's total subscription fees and advertising revenue each month, then prorated for each master based on the number of streams that month. In other words, the DSP computes your company's percentage of the month's total streams, multiplies that percentage times their revenue, then pays out the record company's percentage of revenue to your company. When your company gets the dough, they then figure out your share of it, which is the percentage that your streams bear to your record company's total streams that month. Finally, they take that money and apply your royalty percentage to it. If this isn't clear, refer back to the royalty computation section of Chapter 7 for a more detailed example. For subscription services, in addition to this formula, most of the record company deals have a per-subscriber minimum, also called a per-sub minimum, or PSM. That means the company gets a certain amount for each of the DSP's subscribers, regardless of what the DSP actually collects. For example, the deal might say that payment for the service's use of master recordings can't be less than the record company's percentage of $7 per subscriber. This is to discourage the DSPs from dropping their prices too low. The companies are worried the DSPs might do this just to build up subscribers, or to drive traffic to another product, like Walmart in the old days, when they discounted CDs just to bring in people who buy refrigerators. Here's how it works, using the example of a $10 per subscriber minimum to make the math easier. Let's say the record company's percentage is 50%, meaning the DSP is obligated to pay 50% of its revenue to the labels. If there is a $10 per subscriber minimum, I'm using an easy math number, this is much higher than any real PSM, the DSP can't pay less than 50%, the record company's percentage, of $10, the PSM, meaning it has to pay out $5 for every subscriber. This payout is to all the labels licensing content. So if your company's masters were 30% of the DSP's total streams in a month, they'd get 30% of the $5 per subscriber minimum, meaning $1.50 for each subscriber. This $1.50 is then prorated over all your company's artists, based on each master's number of plays. So if your masters were streamed 200,000 times in a month, and all your record company's masters were streamed 1 million times, your streams were 20% of the company's streams, 200,000 divided by 1 million. Accordingly, 20% of $1.50, 30 cents per subscriber, would be allocated to your masters. You'd then get your royalty rate based on that 30 cents. Meaning, if you had a 10% royalty, you'd get 3 cents per subscriber. Of course, if 50% of the DSP's revenue that's allocated to your company is more than the PSM, you'd get the higher amount. Per stream versus per user. There's a developing controversy over the current system, which I just described, of allocating money based on the number of streams. It certainly sounds fair on the surface. If you get more streams, you get more money. But is it? The argument is whether it would be more equitable to allocate the money on a per-user basis, as opposed to the current system of allocating per stream. Let me explain. I'm a niche artist with an avid but small group of fans. My fans subscribe to Spotify and listen to my music a lot. Because I'm such a small player, my streams are a tiny percentage of the total streams, which means I get a very small piece of the pie under today's system of allocating per stream. What if, instead, I got a share of my fans' specific subscription money, meaning the money was allocated per user? Would that be more fair? Here's a very simplified example. Let's assume there's a streaming service with just two artists, you and me. Also assume there are only two subscribers, Billy and Leo, and they each pay $10 per month, for total subscription fees of $20. And assume the labels get 50% of that money, meaning $10. In the first month, Billy listens only to me and streams my songs 100 times. In that same month, Leo listens only to you, but streams your songs 900 times. Under today's per-stream system, since you had 90% of the listens, the DSP allocates 90% of the $20 total subscription fees to your label, meaning it gets its share of $18. And my label is allocated the remaining 10% of the fees, meaning it gets its share of $2. Since labels' deals with the streaming service are 50%, your label would get 50% of the $18, meaning $9, and my label would get the other $1. Thanks a lot. However, if the allocation was based on per user rather than per stream, the payout would look very different. Since Billy listened only to me, my label would get 50% of Billy's subscription money, meaning 50% of $10, or $5, instead of the $1 under today's system. And your label would only get $5 of Leo's subscription money instead of $9. You're welcome. This would, of course, benefit the smaller artists, and I think it has the ring of extreme fairness. But it's a lot more complicated than my example. Subscribers listen to billions of streams, and I doubt if more than a handful listen to only one artist, if any. So, setting up systems to reallocate like this would be incredibly complex and expensive. A recent article I came across said that the differential would be about 4% of the total money, meaning that 4% would go away from the top streaming artists and be spread around the rest of the system. However, this was based on a very small study in Finland, so I have no idea how accurate it would be overall. If you want to see the article, which will likely be out of date by the time you read this, it's online at Music Business Worldwide, titled "Spotify Still Pays Artists Out of One Big Pot. Should the company change its policy?" Streaming services acknowledge that a user-based allocation could be fairer, but they argue that the cost of setting up and implementing new systems would eat up the differential, not to mention the politics of taking money from top-selling artists who benefit from the current system. So, stick around. This could get interesting. Breakage. Another issue around subscription services today is breakage, which doesn't mean a coffee mug you knocked over in a souvenir shop and now have to buy. It means newer streaming services and new business models that use music have to get licenses to use masters or they can't be in business. Unfortunately, a lot of newer companies have this nasty habit of going broke and stiffing record companies. So to protect themselves from, "Sorry, it didn't work, I'm out of here, Incorporated," the labels get advances up front against future income and/or non-recoupable money. In addition, record labels sometimes get stock in the new business as part of their license, or they might get the right to buy stock as part of their license deal. Let's assume your record company gave a 2-year license to a startup DSP and got a $1 million advance. I'm making up numbers for the example. They actually get much more than that. At the end of the 2 years, the deal is over, so the DSP can no longer use the music. However, the record label only earned $600,000 over the 2 years, meaning $400,000 of the $1 million is unrecouped. Since this was a non-returnable advance, the record company doesn't have to pay back the $400,000 that wasn't earned. This unearned amount, the $400,000 in our example, is called breakage. Breakage also includes non-recoupable money, which of course is never earned back, and arguably the stock they got in the company. So the question is, do artists share in breakage? The companies argue that it's not payment for use of your masters, so you haven't earned a piece of it. And it's true that, unlike royalties, this money isn't earned by any specific master. But we who represent artists argue that there wouldn't be any breakage if there weren't any artists in the catalog, so all the artists should share in it. It's worth asking for a piece of breakage in your deal, and many companies are willing to agree if you have some clout. As a practical matter, all the majors and some of the big independents share breakage with artists even if they're not contractually required to. For example, they share with artists who are under older deals that were done before breakage became a big thing. Most, if not all, companies will now also share the profit they make from taking stock in a new business that licenses their catalog, though this is almost impossible to get contractually. By profit, I mean they'll deduct whatever they paid for the stock and share the excess. Each of the majors has a different way of distributing breakage to their artists. In general, 1. They first look at how your masters performed during the term of the license to which the breakage relates. 2. Next, they compare the results of your performance to the performance of all the company's masters for that time period. 3. The company then computes your percentage of the total performances by dividing the result of number 1 by the result of number 2. 4. Next, they multiply that percentage times the breakage money to determine the share of money that's allocated to your masters. 5. Finally, they multiply the money determined under number 4 times your royalty rate, and the result is your share. This is a little easier to see with numbers. Using our breakage figure of $400,000, if your masters streamed 1 million times during the relevant period, and all the company's masters streamed 10 million times, you'd be allocated 1/10, 10%, of the $400,000 breakage, $40,000. If you have a 15% royalty, you'd get 15% of the $40,000, $6,000. While that's generally the formula, there are differences between the companies in the computations. For example, some labels allocate based only on your streams over the service that generated the breakage, while others look at your streaming numbers on all the services. Some labels also factor in your overall track record with the company, including downloads and CDs. Also, some companies pay your share of breakage as a royalty, meaning it's used to recoup your advances and costs, while others pay it to you whether you're recouped or not. And some won't pay if you're no longer signed to the label when the breakage happens. Downloads. A digital download, which is also called a DPD, standing for Digital Phono Record Delivery, is a transmission to the consumer via internet, satellite, cell phone, mental telepathy, etc., that allows the buyer to download music for later use. Examples are songs sold via the iTunes download store and ringtones. Sales of DPDs are falling quickly, but they're still around as I write this, so let's take a few minutes to understand them. There are two kinds of downloads. 1. Permanent downloads. As the name implies, it's yours forever, and you can copy it, burn it, stomp it, or do anything else your heart desires. Well, actually, not anything. When you sign up with a digital retailer, the fine print you never bothered to read before you click accept contains something called an end-user license agreement. Her friends know her as EULA. In that hot little piece of literature, buried among exciting words and phrases. It says that the downloads are only for your personal, non-commercial use. 2. Tethered downloads. Tether, which is a fancy word for leash, means the service provider doesn't give you complete control over the download. These are also known as conditional downloads. For example, Spotify allows you to load songs onto your phone so you can listen offline, but if you stop paying your subscription, they send little gnomes over the web to eat your music. For iTunes-type permanent downloads, the record companies get what they call a wholesale price equal to 70% of the retail price. The other 30% is kept by the platform, such as iTunes, that sells the download. For example, the labels get about 91 cents for a $1.29 download. So if you have a 10% royalty, you'll get 9.1 cents. Tethered downloads are treated exactly like interactive streaming, meaning you get your royalty rate applied against the company's receipts. Non-interactive streaming and satellite radio. Non-interactive streaming, also called webcasting, means you can only hear what the programmer decides to play, just like over-the-air radio stations. Pandora is by far the biggest non-interactive streamer, and another example is iHeartRadio. Also, there are tons of local radio simulcasts, which means a broadcast that's streamed on the internet at the same time that it's broadcast over the air. A service called TuneIn aggregates the local stations and lets you access them on the internet through your app. On a personal note, I kind of got hooked to a small-town station in Texas, where I particularly like the local ads. I'd never before heard a children's chorus singing a happy tune to advertise a crematorium. Honest. On an even smaller scale, there are individual webcasters who put together music they think is cool and send it out to the world. Most of these webcasts are advertiser-supported, but they can be paid subscription as well. For example, Pandora offers both. Satellite radio, not surprisingly, sends music over a satellite rather than the web. The biggest player in this area by far is SiriusXM, which is subscription-based. SiriusXM is non-interactive, meaning you have to listen to whatever they decide to play. And unlike Pandora, you can't skip songs or customize the content, other than by changing channels, which has been a form of interactivity ever since a second radio broadcaster started transmitting in the 1920s. For non-interactive webcasting and satellite radio, the copyright law requires record companies to license their masters at a rate set by the government. This is called a statutory rate, because the rate is set by a statute, a law. The money is not paid by the broadcaster directly to the labels, but rather is collected by an outfit called Sound Exchange. Exactly what gets paid is pretty complicated, and I want you to stay awake for the moment, so I stuck it further along in the audiobook, in the middle of Chapter 19, if you can't wait. Video streaming. Video streaming deals are the same percentage, mid-50%, as the audio deals, if the video is produced by a record company. All other videos that use music, such as a little old lady moshing to a punk rock track, are called user-generated content, known in the trade as UGC, because they're created by a user of the video service rather than a company. Record companies get a lower rate for UGC than they get for a record company-created video. The only exception is a UGC video that really does nothing more than showcase the music. For example, a video that plays a song all the way through while showing a picture of the album cover, pictures of the artist, lyrics, etc. These showcase videos are paid at the same rate as a video made by the record company. If the UGC is a video of someone sitting at a piano and playing a song, then the record company gets nothing because there's no use of their master. Only the songwriters get paid, and we'll talk about what they get later in Chapter 16. Master Licenses. When masters are licensed by a record company for motion pictures, television shows, and commercials, the company gives you 50% of their net receipts, meaning the company's gross receipts, less any third-party payments, the company's direct costs for duplication, shipping, etc. The amount of money that the companies get for master licenses is almost always the same amount charged by the publishers for use of the song, which we'll discuss in detail at the beginning of Chapter 17. If you listen ahead, don't forget to come back. Samples. Sampling means using a part of your master in someone else's record, or licensing someone else's master for use in your recording. Sampling is a bit legally complicated, so I'd like you to have a few more concepts before we tackle it. When we get to it, at the beginning of Chapter 17, I'll tell you what you can expect if someone samples your master, which is also what you have to pay if you sample someone else's master. Guest artists, featured artists, and joint recordings. A joint recording, keep the puns to yourself, is where more than two or more royalty artists get together on the same song, such as a duet. Joint recording is the term we use in contracts. In the real world, these are called guest artist deals, because one of the artists is guesting on the other artist's record. Or they're called featured artist deals, or collaborations, or I'm more important than you are, so you're lucky to have me on your record. Well, maybe not the last one. These deals are becoming more and more common, particularly in hip-hop and pop. A major guest artist can generate visibility for a lesser-known artist's track, which of course translates into a lot more streams, which translates into more visibility for the artist. How everyone gets paid really isn't covered in your record deal, because it's figured out case by case. When artists decide to collaborate, they negotiate with each other for the royalties and any advances. If you and the other artist aren't signed to the same label, the two labels also have to make a deal with each other before the record can go out. Here's how it works. Guest artist royalties. Historically, the most common arrangement for guest artists was to split the royalty among the artists in proportion to their numbers. So, if it was a duet, each gets half. If there are three artists, each gets a third, etc. This is still the case when two artists of about equal stature get together. But most commonly, the guest artist gets a specific royalty rate. We'll talk about the range of those in a minute. If it's a straight split of royalties, watch out for the following. 1. If you do a duet with a five-piece group, be sure that the group only counts as one entity. Otherwise, the company might say that there are six royalty artists instead of two, you and the group, and you'll only get 1/6 of the royalty instead of 1/2. 2. Whose royalty gets divided, yours or theirs? If you're the star and you're on someone else's record, you want a share of your royalty because it's likely to be higher than the other bozo. If you're new and singing with a star, try for a piece of theirs. Whatever gets divided, it's after deducting third-party royalties, like producers, mixers, and samples. Also, it's paid after recoupment of all costs charged by the record label in connection with the masters, such as recording costs, videos, promotional costs, etc. If, instead of splitting, you negotiate a specific guest royalty, it can run anywhere from a few points, 3% to 4%, if you're just singing a small part on the record, up to 10% for major stars. If the deal is for a negotiated royalty, you shouldn't be reduced for producer or mixer royalties. Sometimes artists do what's called a swap, where the guest takes no royalty in exchange for a future performance by the other artist. For example, if Benjamin appears on Talia's record and takes no royalty, Talia agrees to sing on one of Benjamin's records for no royalty. The problem with swap deals among bigger artists is, A, it's hard to schedule the second recording because there's a tight delivery date and major artists are slammed. B, you're in the middle of promoting your own records and your label doesn't want your voice on someone else's record during that time frame. And C, creatively, you may not like the future track. Guest artist deals get even more complicated in hip-hop and EDM. For example, some guest artists take a tiny royalty but want a huge advance that they can't possibly recoup. Also, some producers think they're artists, so they ask for more points than they'd normally get as a producer. If the guest artist is also a writer, the main artist should require the guest to go along with their controlled composition clause. That means nothing to you because we haven't talked about it yet, but it's an important point, so make a note of it if you're doing a guest deal. We'll get to this baby in Chapter 17. As noted above, often the guest artist and the primary artist are signed to different labels. In this case, you can't do anything until the labels work out a clearance, which we'll discuss in Chapter 13. So it's essential to alert your label as soon as you get a case of guestitis, and certainly don't start recording until the labels have signed off. Apps. Here we're talking about apps that use music as the primary purpose of the app, such as GarageBand, TikTok, BeatFever, karaoke apps, instructional music apps, etc., or that use music as an important element of the app, like Flipagram, video games with music in the background, fitness apps such as Peloton, Aaptive, and SoulCycle. I'm not talking about apps that just let you access streaming music, such as Spotify, Apple Music, or iHeartRadio, which we already covered. The payment for music in apps is a bit all over the place, mostly because the apps are all over the place. If an app isn't primarily a music product, for example, a game where you chase turkeys around the barnyard while listening to death metal, the deal is usually a flat fee in the range of $500 to $10,000 per song, depending on how much of it's used and the stature of the song. These licenses are always short, generally 1 year to 18 months, so if the app succeeds, the company can ratchet up the money on the next round. If an app is monetized, meaning it generates money after the initial download, for example, ad sales, subscription fees, in-app purchases, emoticons, virtual currency, etc., there may be a revenue share on top of the fee, running anywhere from 15% to 35%, depending on usage and the song. In computing these percentages, the app developer wants to deduct the fee that's charged by the platform where consumers get it, e.g., the iTunes Store charges 30% of every purchase, and they also want to deduct the cost of ad sales. These are negotiable by the label, depending on bargaining power, but the norm is to at least allow them to deduct the 30% platform fee. For example, if an app sells for a dollar, iTunes takes 30 cents for selling the app, and the app developer gets 70 cents. If your company's share of the money is 20%, it gets that portion of the 70 cents, meaning 14 cents. If the app is subscriber-based, there will usually be a per-subscriber minimum. We discussed this concept earlier in this chapter. In revenue-sharing deals, there's almost always an advance against the royalty. The amount is totally dependent on the specific situation, importance of the song, and the nature of the use. It can run from $100 per song into the thousands. Sometimes these are deals for all the masters in the company's catalog, subject to the artist's approval where required. And in that case, the advance can be really big bucks. Even if the app has no revenue after the initial download, the record companies sometimes charge a yearly fee, a flat fee or a minimum per user, for as long as your music is in the app. Note this means the app developers are paying these fees out of their own pocket because there's no additional money coming in. They're willing to do this because they're building up a user base, which makes their business more valuable, and that's more important to them than making a profit in the short term. Another variation is called a step deal, where there's an initial fee and an additional fee for a certain number of downloads. A recent trend is for record companies to ask that app developers link to a Spotify or Apple Music account. In other words, the music isn't embedded in the app, but rather linked to a DSP that streams the music. That way, each time the song is streamed, the label gets paid under its deal with the streaming service. You might be surprised to hear that song identifiers like Shazam and SoundHound don't pay for music at all. That's because they don't actually have any music in their apps. All they do is digitally fingerprint the music, meaning they break it down into little digital chunks, then match those identifiers against what they're hearing. The labels all have to deal with these apps because they view the service as highly promotional. For example, Shazam lets you add a song to your Spotify playlist when you identify it. Even more important, the labels want the app's data of which songs people are chasing down. If you're on the fast track, skip ahead to the end of this chapter, starting with accountings. Ringtones and ringbacks. Ringtones are short clips of songs that play when your cell phone rings. Ringbacks happen when you call someone, and instead of hearing an annoying ringing signal, you hear an annoying song. Ringtones are something you download and own, while ringbacks are held on the server of the phone service provider, so you're only renting them. Ringtones and ringbacks were at one time a surprisingly strong business, doing sales in the billions per year. But they took a major nosedive when it became easy to make your own for free. Currently, they're not a big source of income. Ringtones started out as polyphonic, which means the song was played by a synthesizer. But nowadays, almost all of them are the actual master recording by the artist, called a master tone or a true tone. If it's polyphonic, you have nothing to do with it as an artist. The only one who gets paid is the songwriter. We'll discuss how much the songwriter gets in Chapter 15. If it's a master recording, the record company gets paid by the ringtone company and then pays you a share equal to your royalty rate. For master tones, the companies get about 50% of the retail price charged to the customer, sometimes with a minimum amount per sale. The minimum puts a floor on what the record company gets, no matter how low the consumer price drops. So if a ringtone is $2, the record company gets $1, and if you have a 10% royalty, you'll get 10 cents. Video games. Here we're talking about true video games. Think Grand Theft Auto, rather than apps, which we just discussed. Except for games where music is an essential part, like Guitar Hero, RIP, the licenses are on a flat fee basis. And the fees are low because the video companies don't believe that any particular song means more people will play the game. The fees that labels get for these deals are the same amounts that songwriters get, which we'll discuss later in Chapter 17. Bundles. A bundle is a combination of stuff, a bundle of products, so to speak, that you get for a single price. For example, if you buy a concert ticket and get a code that allows you to download the album for free. Another example is where you get a basic music streaming service when you subscribe to Amazon Prime. What you get for bundled services are all